this is Kevin Dixon, and a big welcome to A Talk on the Buyer Side. I'm your host, and I'm also the founder of PoxStep, a sales platform that aligns the selling with the buying. We're a sales podcast with a difference, because this is all about the buyers, and in today's complex markets, it's their perspectives that really matter. We'll be having buyer-side chats with decision makers and industry experts to understand more about buying challenges, what salespeople do well, what they need to improve on, and how they can help in the buying process. Join us as we explore the concept of facilitation and collaboration with B2B buyers. Hello, everybody. Well, I am fired up today because we are upgrading on the intellectual level and contributions provided by Dixon with my namesake, Matt Dixon. Welcome, Matt.
Kevin, it's great to be here. Whenever I get reached out to by another Dixon, I always accept the invite. So thank you for that. Yeah. But you've set the bar pretty high. I know a lot of intellectual Dixons out there. So.
Well, it's funny, really. I always think, but I don't know about how to you. It's a bit of a side. But when I was a school child, I was always grateful that Dixon, I had the name spelt with an X.
Yeah.
CK, because kids can be cruel.
It's the same in the States. Yeah.
So yeah, we're collaborating with the right sort of mentality there. For anybody listening, you're wondering, okay, why have I got Matt in here? Well, if it's a name you probably know, because if you've been around in sales long enough, then you would have probably come across the challenge sale and the challenger customer, which were books. When did you write those, Matt? A while back. Now.
Challenger sale was 2011, and challenger customer, I think, was 2015.
Okay. Now, if I remember rightly, the challenger sale came out probably when the Financial Times were pretty tough.
Yeah.
And it was tough to get anyone to buy anything.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, we wrote the book in the setup for the book, for those who've read it will remember, it was precipitated, if you will, by the financial crisis when, as you said, people were missing their numbers by a very wide margin, but heads of sales noticed that certain individuals within their sales team were still hitting their numbers, were still closing deals, were bringing in great business that they would dream of in the best of times, but they were doing it in a really tough economic environment. So we went out to study that. What it ended up being was a story less about selling in a downturn and more about selling to information-empowered customers. You know, customers who are left to their own devices will box you out, will force you and your competitors to compete on price, and how do you counteract that? So a much bigger story, and I think that's the reason it's carried through to today, you know,
definitely had an impact lots of. But before anyone else starts thinking, blimey, what the hell are we talking about a book that came out 11 years ago for? Well, the good news, everybody, is Matt has got a new book coming out in September. And this one is bang on in my level of interest because tell you what, I nearly jumped in then. Matt, tell me about the book you wrote with Ted.
Yeah, so we started some research back in March of 2020, and I'll geek out here for just a moment. As a sales researcher, I think, you know, Ted, myself, many of my colleagues over the years, the gold standard in sales research was always Professor Neil Rackham's work in spin selling. You know, you think about the number of sales calls he sat in, the time it took to do that analysis, the number of variables they looked at to produce the work spin selling. And that's always been the gold standard. And, you know, I always had in the back of my mind, boy, I'd love to go kind of replicate that study or go do something like that. Go study, you know, really where the rubber hits the road. And if you think about Challenger and Challenger customer, those were both studies done with surveys, right, which are obviously kind of post facto. And there are levels of interpretation that happen when one fills out a survey, a lot of interviews, research interviews. But it wasn't actually us doing what Neil did back in the day, sitting in the room present when those sales conversations were happening. And so the problem with studying sales conversations in the way that Neil Rackham did was that it was super expensive and it was impractical in some respects, because the really important sales meetings, well, you know, even before 2020, some of the sales conversations had started to move to Zoom and over the phone, Teams, et cetera. The important ones still took place in the client's office, you know, and And there was no scenario in which I was going to be invited in, my research team was going to be invited in. In no way I could get a sponsoring organization to underwrite, an unknown exploration into the sales wilderness until March of 2020 rolled around. And then something interesting happened, at least for us as sales researchers, which is sales went 100% virtual overnight. And we all remember this. And it's starting to creep back, right? But it's still heavily virtual in most industries. And this created a golden opportunity for us as sales researchers. So Ted McKenna and I partnered with several dozen companies across industry around the world and started harvesting sales calls. And we collected 2.5 million sales calls in all, transcribed those and used machine learning to study them. So I think of this as maybe a modern day version of Neil's book of Spin Selling. Now,
about, what's that, 80, 90 times more data?
Something like that. We had 8,300 variables in our model. So it was a huge, huge study. And it was way more cost effective, actually, for us to do that with modern technology. You know, GPU processing, natural language processing, machine learning platforms suddenly made this kind of study practical in a way that even a few years ago, it would not have been. Now, what we decided to study was this age old question, which back to your question, what's the book about? Is this age old question of why salespeople lose so often to no decision. And I think, you know, despite all the advances in sales and sales thinking out there, and I'd say, you know, I think we contributed to that in some way with Challenger and Challenger Customer in our previous work. Still today, if you ask the average salesperson if they're more likely to lose to the competition or to no decision, they'd say they're far more likely to lose to no decision. They find it far fewer opportunities are lost to a named competitor. It's usually that the customer chooses to do nothing, right? They lose to inaction. And so we went about studying this, which arguably was a similar vein or a similar problem we tried to tackle in Challenger. But, you know, this problem hasn't really gone away. If anything, it's gotten, in our data, we've seen it's gotten worse over time. And we have a point of view around why it's going to continue to get worse. But what we found was pretty eye-opening in terms of what causes customers to not do anything, and then what salespeople need to do to counteract that.
Yeah, it's like, what is the latest research? Because I hear all the time, no decision. I tend to take sort of rule of thumb, it's about half the deals. Because some people say 40, some 60, I've seen 75, and you think, well, hold on. But if we take half as a sort of benchmark, then it's probably not far off, depending on what industry you're in or what you sell. Yep. The irony is, though, Matt, is I talk to sales leaders every day because of, you know, our platform sort of align with this space and things like that. And I ask them a bunch of things, you know, do you track your no decisions? Mm-hmm. And it's almost like as soon as a customer has a no decision, it's like, well, you're dead to me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so that we've moved on.
Yeah.
You know, they don't even think of it as a loss.
Yeah.
You know, but no decision. I when I talk to people, I say no decisions is the biggest opportunity landscape that we have in sales.
100%. I agree. Absolutely. In fact, your numbers are really accurate, even though you're just spitballing, but you're spot on, actually. We found it was between 40 and 60% of losses are actually due to no decision. And the reason there's a range is that in complex sales, it actually happens less frequently. And I think in part that's because really large sales organizations spend a bit more time around that pre-qualification, disqualification. You know, it's a significant expense for a company to sell to another business. And if you think about the sales team, the subject matter experts, the solutions engineers, all the people on your side who are going to invest time to selling an opportunity, you've got to really be careful and provide a bit of scrutiny around those opportunities and whether they're really worth your time. But still, 40% is a lot. Now, as deals become more transactional, that number starts to creep up. We found it was actually closer to 60% when you look at inside sales and more product-focused sales. But the benchmark, you're right, around 50% as a rule of thumb is where most organizations would reside.
Yeah, one of the other things I discover as well, and I ask this every single time, I say, when you're talking to your prospects, and most of my customers are involved in complex enterprise or technology sales, and people interpret complex differently. A lot of people see complex as it's a complex technology. Mm-hmm. I tend to view it as complex because the people add the complexity and the process adds the complexity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But more often than not, when I speak to people, is they're only engaging with probably about half the people they should be. And that's always going to be an issue. So what's the book called?
Yeah,
and let's go through that, because this is the tasty bit.
Yeah, let me tell you a little bit about, I'll tell you a little bit about the book, and maybe I'll get, if it's all right, I'll share a little bit of, around what we found and what was so surprising.
Yeah, definitely.
No decision. So the book is called The Jolt Effect. Now, Jolt is both an acronym and it's sort of an action word about what's happening. And I'll get to that in a moment. So remember that I owe you an explanation of what Jolt means in a moment. Well, let me back up a little bit. So we tried to unpack these, the reasons for no decision. And I think one of the things we always do as researchers is we go back and we reflect and read quite a bit around what is the conventional wisdom, if you will, in sales around why customers end up not doing anything, why we lose to inaction, why we lose to no decision. And I don't think I'm going to say anything that's going to surprise you, is that the conventional wisdom is that when we lose to no decision, what we're really losing to is the customer status quo, right? So either we've not created a burning platform for that customer, we've not dialed up what we call in Challenger, the pain of same, right? The cost of the status quo, or we've not given the customer a compelling enough reason to leave the status quo, right? Because the future state, the new way forward, using our platform, using our product, our service is not compelling enough to the customer. So they may agree that the status quo is suboptimal, but your solution doesn't represent a compelling enough alternative to go through the change journey, pay extra money for it, et cetera. So it's usually one of those two things. We're trying to get the customer from A to B. And the belief is we either haven't made the A feel painful enough or we haven't made the B seem compelling enough to the customer. And so when we dug into the data, we found something pretty startling, which is that only about 44% of losses that end up in inaction are actually a function of the customer's preference for the status quo. So it's only 44% of the time. So less than half the time, it's because the customer either doesn't believe their current situation is that bad, or they don't believe your new solution represents a more compelling alternative. It turns out 56% of the time, the bigger chunk of deals lost to inaction are a function of the customer not willing or able to make a decision. Now, these are, just to be clear, these are customers who will tell you, Kevin, I am sold. The status quo is horrible. We've got to leave. It's costing us money. It's exposing us to risk. It's costing us market share. It's horrible. We've got to leave. And they will tell you, I love your platform. And we've done all our homework. And we think you guys are the guys we want to do business with. And still, 56% of the time, they won't pull the trigger, execute the DocuSign, send back the contract. And it's because they don't buy that the A state is that bad or the B state could be that great. It's something else. Now, as we unpack, this was confusing to us because, again, we grew up in this world, and arguably Challenger is a great example. We talk about challengers as better at showing the customer the pain of same is worse than the pain of change. They're very good at overcoming that status quo. So, you know, what else could there be? What other explanation could there be? As we started to unpack this, we came to understand indecisiveness and indecision at a much more human level. And I know, you know, you focus quite a bit on buyer enablement. And I think there's a big buyer enablement story wrapped up in the data here, which we'll get to in a moment. But let me share a little bit about what is indecision and how does it differ from a preference for the status quo? What we found in the research is that a few things. The first is that when customers become indecisive, that's quite different from their bias for the status quo. The bias for the status quo is a function of the customer's preference for things to remain as they are, largely because people are very lazy and it takes a lot to get them to change. Even when you put a more compelling alternative in front of them, it takes a lot to get them to move off their status quo. We know that in sales. What the indecisive state is driven by, customer indecision is actually not driven by a preference for the status quo or a preference for things to remain as they are. It's driven by the customer's preference to not personally make a mistake. And it turns out this is driven by a psychological bias called the omission bias. And the omission bias holds that all things being equal, if I had two paths in front of me, path one is I do nothing and I end up with a bad result. And path two is I do something, I make a decision and I end up with the same exact bad result. I will choose path one every day of the week and twice on Sunday. What people really want to avoid is being personally responsible, personally culpable for a mistake, even if the outcome is exactly the same. So what that tells us is that even if a customer agrees, the status quo is terrible, your new way forward sounds awesome, I love your platform, love what you're talking about, they still get cold feet because they are worried about making a mistake. Now, what are the mistakes they're worried about making? It turns out there are three, according to social science. The first is they're worried they didn't pick the right thing. And when I say that, they think about even if they picked your company, think about all the ways one could configure your platform, all the ways they could buy your solution. There's different contract length. There's with the professional services or without. I could use a partner to help install it. I could do this on my own. I could pay for premium service or not. I could go broad and buy a lot of seat licenses, or we could do a narrow pilot and start in this part of the business and then expand from there. So there are a lot of different configurations that we offer. And the customer's thinking, what if I picked the wrong one? What if I should have gone for the 2-year contract and instead I signed the 3-year, and then we realize after 1 year, this platform doesn't work for us and I'm stuck with a 3-year commitment, things like that. The second concern, the second fear, the second mistake the customer's worried about making is that they haven't done enough homework. And think about all the information out there, how much there is to consume before making a purchase decision. What the customer's fear is that it's the white paper they didn't read, or the webinar they didn't attend, or the analyst they didn't talk to that has all the answers and is going to help them avoid making a big purchasing mistake. So they need to continue to do homework and do research until they feel satisfied that they are an expert in what the decision they're about to make. The last one, the last mistake, is called outcome uncertainty. Outcome uncertainty is this voice in the back of the customer's head that's saying, you know, the demos were great. The reference calls were wonderful. The ROI calculation, the proposal looks spot on. But what if we're the one customer who doesn't get what the returns that this vendor is projecting? What if I'm left holding the bag? Well, if that happens, then my boss is going to come wondering who spent all this money on this solution. And guess what? They're going to start with the person whose name is on the DocuSign, and that's me, right? So these are the three mistakes that salespeople are, or that customers are worried about committing. And the way we've described this in the book is that, you know, in sales, we've always been taught that the status quo is our biggest, if not only, competitor. It's the only thing you really need to worry about. As long as you show the customer the pain of same, or the new way forward is compelling, is pain of same is terrible, the new way forward is compelling, you're good. And if the customer starts to get cold feet, it must be because you didn't do a good enough job overcoming or beating the status quo. But what the research shows is that we've got to have a beat the status quo playbook. And I would argue Challenger is a good example of that. Challenger customer as well. You've got to overcome the status quo. And if you don't, your customer's not going to buy anything, right? If they believe things are good right now, if they don't believe your solution's a better alternative, they're not buying anything. But at some point, when the customer is committed that the status quo is suboptimal, your solution represents a better alternative, you've got to switch gears. And you've got to put that playbook down and pull out your JOLT playbook, which is your playbook for overcoming customer indecision. Now, we'll get into JOLT in a moment, but I'll share one last thought with you, which is something surprising in the research. Remember what I said before, we've always been taught in sales that it's when the customer gets cold feet, when they start wavering and backpedaling and waffling, it's because we've not overcome the status quo. So we've got to go back and hammer it, right? We've got to dial up the pain. We use the FUD, right? Fear, uncertainty, and doubt. We help the customer really paint this rosy picture of life with our solution and our product and our service. It turns out that that happens when the customer wavers, and we studied this in the data. When the customer starts to show signs of indecision, 73% of salespeople go right back to the status quo. And did you know that that backfires 84% of the time? And the reason it backfires is that what we're doing is we're taking a customer who's not worried about the status quo. They're sold on leaving the status quo, but they're worried about something else. It's one of those three mistakes. And we're going back and we're doing kind of wash, rinse, and repeat with that beat the status quo playbook, and effectively increasing the odds they make no decision, because all we're doing really is using fear to sell to a customer who's already scared, right? Which it turns out is a pretty bad sales strategy. So the sales approach we talk about in the book is the JOLT playbook, which stands for four different behaviors, which I'll grab a drink of coffee and then we'll talk more about that.
on that 84%, I think for me is that's a standout stat, because I know for a fact, I think we've all done it in sales leadership.
Of course, yeah.
We've sort of said, well, look, if they're not moving forward, you've got to go back and reassert value, reassert benefits. Yep. And now you've come up with this research too late, Matt.
Right. It's never too late.
But the issue is I suppose, like you said, you've got the benefits of the technology to process it cost effectively, yeah, to sort of give us that sort of information.
Yeah.
No decision is one of those things that I have all too often as a conversation. And the way you've now viewed it is, you're right. No decision was immediately tagged with no decision equals not convinced to change from the status quo.
Right.
And that's the default that we all fall on.
Yeah.
So this is perfect. I'm super excited to get the book. You've had your coffee slurp. John.
Yeah. Perfect. So just as some of, we're talking about the, you know, if we've got these two playbooks now, so it's not one, we've got two now as salespeople to get the customer from their current state to buying our solution. And the first playbook is beat the status quo. That is all about dialing up the fear of not purchasing. Here's what you're going to miss out on. You're going to be stuck with your terrible legacy solution. You're going to be stuck doing things the way you are. You're going to miss, you're going to lose ground to competitors. That's about overcoming the status quo, beating the status quo, right?
Well, one thing about that as well, I think that the way that the buying committee, as it's known, has grown, because I actually say selling now is probably more about people management than opportunity management. And the fact that the more it's multiplying, the complexity of that fear.
Oh, yeah.
People have different reasons for fear.
That's right.
I say that every person on that buying committee is either in the middle or they're going to suffer pain or gain from change.
Yeah.
And understanding who benefits and who suffers and why at least gives you the opportunity to try and revisit it.
You're quite right. Yeah. In fact, that was the follow-on book, The Challenger Customer, really talked about that idea of consensus buying. And you're right. It is a difficulty multiplier for the salesperson. And in this challenge of indecision is the same, right? So you can imagine a buying committee with each of those different stakeholders being indecisive for different reasons, right? In having a different one of, or some combination of those fears. But as I was saying before, the beat the status quo playbook is all about dialing up the fear of not purchasing. Overcoming the status quo is about actually dialing down the fear of purchasing. So how do we get our customer more comfortable about this decision they're about to make? And so we identified four behaviors. We call it the JOLT method or the JOLT approach. So let me walk through each of them very quickly. The J stands for judging the indecision. And this is ultimately about, as a salesperson, understanding the depths, the source and depth of our customer's indecisiveness. So it's not about being a psychologist and having our customer sit on a couch and doing a bit of a Rorschach test, but it is about listening for different indicators of indecisiveness. And one of the things we learned from interviews we ran with high performers is that they qualify opportunities not just on the customer's ability to buy, but also, it turns out, on their ability to decide. And those are two different things. And so we break apart in that J chapter all of the different litmus tests, the things that high performers are listening for that often go right over the head of the average salesperson that are indicators, warning signs that this is a customer that's going to be difficult to get across. They're struggling with something else. I've got to actually be able to manage that indecision. And at the very, it might tell us we disqualify that opportunity if they're deeply indecisive, but it might also tell us we just forecast it differently and we need to apply resourcing in our approach differently. There's really nowhere to hide when it comes to indecision. We found that 87% of all the opportunities in our study had customers that displayed either moderate or high levels of indecision. So in other words, the decisive customers are the exception. They're more like finding a needle in the haystack of indecisiveness. So it's just sort of the norm, but we do know in that J is all about high performers getting their bearings on where the indecision is coming from and how deep it is. Now the O is all about offering your recommendation. So you may be familiar and your listeners may be familiar with the work around decision theory and the paradox of choice. And look, we all know that offering lots of options, so many configurations, so many different partners and plugins and so on and so forth, so many different ways to apply our solution in their business is really attractive to people when they're shopping. But when they're buying, we've actually got to narrow that playing field up. We've got to chalk the field and we've got to actually shift from asking them what they want to buy to telling them what they should buy, but doing it in a way that's not kind of, it's not directive in the way it comes across, but rather guiding the customer with a firm and personal recommendation that, look, I know we've put a lot in front of you, but personally, I think this is the right solution for your organization. Here's why. And I think we move forward with this and I don't think we look back. And by the way, if your needs change, we'll structure the contract in a way that we can expand with you, right? And we can adapt with you. But the customer needs to be told at some point, this is the right decision. Ignore options A and C, it's option B. And that's the one we should go with. Now the L is all about, is called limiting the exploration. So we know there's so much content out there in every industry around every purchase decision. If you think about user reviews, you think about all the opinions you can get on LinkedIn and other places. You think about the analyst reports, the magic quadrants, the wave reports. You think about third-party purchasing consultants, the blog posts. I mean, there's just a mountain of information out there. And what high performers know is that the customer is never going to become as smart as they are about what they're about to buy. At some point, you've got to get the customer to effectively trust you and trust that they're in good hands and to follow your lead. And so we distilled a set of behaviors that high performers use to basically shut down the exploration at some point, limit it, and keep it within the guardrails where it's enough information the customer feels confident, but not so much that they spin their wheels. Because it turns out, when average performers just feed the beast and continue to give content and information to the customer, they make it more likely the customer ends up doing nothing. Because again, there's always that fear that it's the next white paper, it's the one I didn't read that'll have all the answers for me. The T is taking risk off the table. So when in the final hours, and when the customer is hovering over that contract with a pen in hand or look staring at the DocuSign and about to hit execute and send it back, we've got to overcome that outcome uncertainty, the fear that they might be left holding the bag, this whole thing may go sideways. And so what are the things we can do in sales to make the customer feel like they're not taking a huge leap of faith? There's some confidence givers there, and this varies, right? In simple sales, we found that opt-out clauses and money-back guarantees and things like that were relied on by best salespeople. And what's funny is, in many of these companies, every salesperson had the option to use those, but average salespeople tended not to, because their fear is, if I tell the customer that, then they'll invoke that clause and then I won't get paid on the opportunity. High performers are comfortable in the value proposition, so, and they use that as a safety net to convince the customer, you've got nothing to lose here. This is, you know, you won't be left holding the bag. If it does go sideways, you can always back out. In more complex sales, we found salespeople using creative contract structuring, actually proactively suggesting more professional services. And one of the really interesting ones was proactively telling the customer, you know, I know we've put in front of you a really big multi-business unit rollout, all of your users, all of your geographies and your markets. I think we actually might want to narrow that up. Let's actually start smaller. Let's scope this down. And I think by doing so, it's going to put a lot less pressure on you. It's going to allow us to get some success under our belts, and then we can move forward with confidence, right? And what they know is they ultimately—
all contracts better than no contracts.
100%. And I think these high performers learn that probably the hard way, that you will sell more sometimes by selling less right now. Now, there's a lot of research out there in people talking about high quality deals, right? A high quality deal has to be bigger. It has to be more profitable. It has to be more expansive. But when we talk to high performers, they tell us that, no, that's not really how— I think actually a high quality deal is one that's well-positioned, well-sized for this customer, for their risk appetite, and then positioned in a way that we can get some victories and then we can expand from there. So that's the JOLT framework. And what I like about it, I mentioned this to you before we started talking, but I like it because it's very actionable. I've been presenting this out to sales organizations a little bit this year at sales kickoffs. And what's really rewarding is hearing people tell me afterward, you know, my team was using the JOLT in our pipeline reviews on specific deals, you know, the afternoon after I presented, which, you know, it brings it's a level of practicality, I think, that's kind of rewarding to see people grab onto it and realize, holy cow, that's not why the customer's not getting back to me. That's not why the customer has cold feet. It's something else. We need to diagnose for that source of indecision and the depth of that indecision, and then apply that framework to help get the customer unstuck and moving forward.
I think you're definitely going to trigger some thinking, some rethinking, because I think most of the time sales teams are going about things the wrong way. Still very seller-centric. We're not looking at the buyer's perspective. We're not putting ourselves in their shoes.
That's right.
There's not enough analytics done by sales teams today on no decisions and why. So that's probably why it's until you get compelling evidence like you're creating in your research, it's never going to trigger that contemplation, thought for change, etc.
Yeah.
Now, I know you wrote it with Ted, and it's a bit of an aside. Yeah. I've always been curious, when you co-author a book, how does that work? Because I think trying to get two people to be so parallel in their thinking, so aligned, how does that work?
Yeah, you know, it's I think with every co-author, you end up figuring out the right division of labor. And I think for us, the way we approach it, Ted is the sort of I call him the data geek and the machine learning geek. And so he was the guy who would interface with our data science team to actually, you know, work through the predictive model, what the output meant. He would bring some of his insights to me, and then he and I would kind of wrestle with them in terms of how do we take this data and what story does it tell us? And what does it point to for salespeople and for managers and for sales leaders? What does it mean for buyers, right? And so we would craft the story, and then I would usually take the first crack at writing it, and then Ted would tell me, you know, what I wrote made no sense, or was I, you know, he'd go back and beat it up, and we'd kind of iterate. And there were some parts of the book that he took the lead on. So we I think, you know, every partnership's different. The way I worked with Brent on Challenger, and I worked as a bigger team, it's actually four co-authors on Challenger Customer. And the way we worked together was quite different. So I think you kind of figure things out pretty quickly, like where each person's strengths are and kind of
get. Yeah, I've often thought, people have asked me about writing a book, and I thought, have I got the patience? And then people talk to me about co-authoring a book.
Yeah.
And then I thought, God, anyone had to put up with me would probably end up shooting me anyway. But anyway, look, I cannot tell you how excited I am. The problem is, it's the same anticipation I have for the new NFL season. It's not until September. But the good news is people can pre-order already. I've pre-ordered.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So you can go to the Penguin Random House site and you can pre-order it or go wherever fine books are sold. So Amazon, for instance, and look it up there again, The Jolt Effect, How High Performers Overcome Indecision. And then we're in the process actually simultaneously as we're finishing this book, launching a new business as well. So if people want to learn more about me or Ted or some of the research that we've done in our careers and what we're doing in our new business, the company's name is DCM Insights, and it's dcminsights.com if you want to. And there's some additional research you can download from there for people who really need a good amount of bedtime reading before the before the book comes out.
Anyone in sales, pre-order the book. Anyone in business leadership, reach out to DCM and start talking to you guys about how you can help them in their business.
That'd be great.
Yeah. That sounds good.
Sounds perfect.
It's been an absolute pleasure, Matt.
Kevin, thank you.
From one Dixon to another. So on behalf of all the listeners, thank you for sharing that. And I'll tell you what, we'll do another one end of the year when I've wolfed down your book.
Yeah, perfect.
And because I'm inevitably going to have some questions about it.
Oh, for sure.
You know, yeah. And some of them will be stupid, but some of them will be great.
I doubt that you're a Dixon.
I don't think it's a problem asking stupid questions, because if you get a good answer, then at least you're not going to ask the customer a stupid question. This has been an absolute pleasure, Matt. So on behalf of everyone, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Kevin. I appreciate it.